Hi, it's Elise Lunan, host of Pulling the Thread. Today's guest is the wonderful Lynn Twist, author of The Soul of Money, though today we're going to talk about her just-released book, Living a Committed Life.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. One in four students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Hi, it's Elise Lunan, host of Pulling the Thread. I'm an author, podcast host, and parent who built a long career in media. I grew up in a state of perpetual curiosity, investigating the world and asking a lot of questions. In this show, I chat with culture-defining leaders, thinkers, and experts about this rare moment that we find ourselves in and how to think about our own lives and experiences within a larger social and spiritual construct.
Life devoted to something larger than yourself is a life worth living. It's a life that is in recognition of life is given to us. It's given to us so that we can give it. We're blessed so that we can bless. We're born, I think, I can't prove this, but I've experienced it, to make the contribution that's uniquely ours to make. And when you find that dharma, that discover that who you are-ness is a match for what's wanted in the world. Oh my God, it's so thrilling that I wanted to do everything I could to make that available to people. Because it's not only wonderful for you, the world needs us now. The world always did, but now the crises are so deep, so profound, so intense, so everywhere, so in every part of society, in every economic class, in every country, in every language, in every culture, that it's all hands on deck. And what a thrilling time to be alive when it's an all hands on deck moment.
So says Lynn Twist. Lynn is a world-renowned visionary committed to alleviating poverty, ending world hunger, and supporting social justice and sustainability. Her 40-year career has taken her from working with Mother Teresa in Calcutta to the refugee camps in Ethiopia and the threatened rainforests of the Amazon, to guiding the philanthropic efforts of some of the world's wealthiest families. Her breadth of experience led her to found the Soul of Money Institute, where she has worked with hundreds of thousands of people all over the world on topics such as fundraising with integrity, practicing conscious philanthropy, and creating a healthy relationship with money. Lynn first translated her stories and life experiences into the best-selling book, The Soul of Money, Transforming Your Relationship with Money and Life, though she joins us today to discuss her latest, Living a Committed Life, Finding Freedom and Fulfillment in a Purpose Larger than Yourself. In the book and in our conversation, Lynn reveals the guiding principles that have enabled her to live as a thought leader and activist, teaching us that a committed life is one worth living. That sometimes the commitment alone is enough to ensure that it happens. The universe is telling us repeatedly that we are in this together, she says, and in a world that sometimes feels chaotic and devoid of meaning, it's incumbent that we draw together around what it means to be human. Okay, let's get to our conversation. I now have three copies of your new book, which is...
How did that happen?
I don't know, but I runneth over with your new book. It's a sign from the universe. And as you know, I'm such a fan of The Soul of Money. In fact, I wrote about you and I wrote about that book specifically. I have a book coming out next spring about women
and the seven deadly sins and what we police in ourselves and in each other. So your book was foundational when I was working through greed and women and money and
Oh, good. Yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you. Wow.
So I highlighted your book intensively, this last book, which is, there's so many really beautiful moments, and we'll go through the parts at least that really hit me in the heart. And I know that you've spent your life in a committed way, but can you talk about that as sort of the organizing thesis of this book, of living a committed life?
Well, let's see. Discovered really that I was living a committed life while I was doing it. And I'm, you know, in the book, I talk about how to create conditions where you can find your committed life. But those conditions were created for me. And I just need to admit that I was fortunate enough to meet Buckminster Fuller and Werner Erhard right in the same period of my life as a young woman, and was super, super transformed by those two human beings and their way of living and being and the way of seeing the world. And when I was able to help them meet each other, then the miracle that was born out of that was the Hunger Project. And I became a midwife to something that wanted to happen, that would have happened maybe anyway, but I was lucky enough to be there in the right place at the right time. And then it swept me off my feet, and I became completely, let's say, almost in love with the idea that a human being like me, that anybody could make that kind of a difference with their life. And it became the center of my parenting, the center of my marriage, the center of my worldview, the center of my way of walking in the world. And I've had such an awesome life as a result, a life I couldn't have planned. I couldn't have, you know, if someone had said, you know, you can have any life you want, I wouldn't have thought this one up, because I would have thought it was impossible, you know? So I realized somewhere along the way that, and I started talking about this, I use this phrase, committed life, where my commitments, my vision for the world, and my commitment to that vision is so much bigger than I could ever accomplish by myself. Or that I can probably ever see in my own lifetime. So it's so humbling. You realize the only way to be effective is to become the instrument of something and to collaborate with everybody everywhere. And that gives you relationships that are so awesome that you kind of have to pinch yourself. Like, you know, I always like to say to people that I worked with Mother Teresa, because people can't even believe that. And I can't either. So I have to kind of say it to believe it myself. And, you know, someone like Desmond Tutu was in my life, you know, and I think, holy moly, et cetera. And then people like you, people like the people listening to this, who would be drawn to something like living a committed life. That is a life not starring yourself, although you're kind of critical to it, but a life that's way bigger than your life starring you. And your life starring you can be such a burden, you know, trying to measure up and fit in and look good and be thin or be young or be smart or be everywhere you want to be and everywhere you think you should be and be everything to everybody you think you should be. It's just exhausting and not very satisfying. But a life devoted to something larger than yourself is a life worth living. It's a life that is in recognition of life is given to us. It's given to us so that we can give it. We're blessed so that we can bless. We're born, I think, I can't prove this, but I've experienced it, to make the contribution that's uniquely ours to make. And when you find that dharma, that discover that who you are-ness is a match for what's wanted in the world. Oh my God, it's so thrilling that I wanted to do everything I could to make that available to people, because it's not only wonderful for you, the world needs us now. The world always did, but now the crises are so deep, so profound, so intense, so everywhere, so in every part of society, in every economic class, in every country, in every language, in every culture, that it's all hands on deck. And what a thrilling time to be alive, when it's an all hands on deck moment. And it is. Yeah. It is. So that's why.
No, certainly. I mean, we're going to dig into all of that. But what I love sort of at the beginning of the book, you set up this foundational idea that you write, people often think that great leaders are born, not made, that they are somehow destined for greatness. I believe, however, it's the opposite, that committing oneself to an inspiring cause is what forges you into a great human being. And that you write about how you don't have to be smart enough or extremely talented or knowledgeable enough to commit. And that once you make that commitment, then the resources and what you need invariably come your way. It's sort of putting yourself in that flow of the river guides you to where you need to go. And that's such a beautiful life because I think, or beautiful idea, because I think so many people struggle from imposter syndrome or an excess of humility, right? Of like, how could I possibly do anything meaningful, particularly in the context of sort of the great social change that's required. But like you, I think everyone, it's an all hands on deck. And that it's a much more having a feeling like I'm trying to make this transition at this stage of my life. It feels so, so incredibly meaningful and rich. And I would say for anyone who's listening who hasn't read The Soul of Money, which is really about this idea of enoughness and a different concept of abundance. And there are some amazing Mother Teresa stories in there. For everyone who's listening who's sort of transfixed or caught in that idea of scarcity or feeling like they couldn't possibly move into something a little bit more service oriented. You can, I promise.
Yeah. Oh, girl. Yes.
And I know you're a spiritual person. I am as well. But you also talk about it as sort of that not being a requirement for doing this work. Can you talk a little bit more about that for people who, I think most of the people who listen to this are quite spiritual, but for people who aren't, how does that, but I feel like anyone can understand sort of a resonance or a synchronicity or that goodness, right? That maybe lights up your heart.
Yeah. Well, one way of looking at it without labeling it God or spirit or, you know, something that an atheist or someone who's agnostic might not relate to. It's the power of love. And love and vitality, aliveness, what makes life worth living. When you love what you're doing, when you love that you have the privilege and opportunity of doing it or being it or engaging in it, it's extraordinary. And you end up loving the people you're doing it with. And they end up loving you. And that's what we all want, you know, no matter what our belief systems are. No one can deny that giving and receiving love is what we're made of, you know, why we were born in many ways. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make just a little adjustment or a comment. When you said something about humility, I want to make a distinction. I think I make this in the book. I can't remember what's in there and what's not. But I've learned in my life that humility is different than modesty.
Yeah.
And mostly we're engaged in modesty, which is false. And I would say modesty is the flip side of arrogance. You know, modesty is being afraid to be arrogant.
Yeah. So
it's just another form of arrogance. When we're, oh, it wasn't my doing. Oh, I didn't do it. Oh, I could never do that. Oh, that's way over my head. Those kinds of statements, which we all make and we kind of get hooked by, are in one way a kind of arrogance. And I'll explain this to you with a story. I have a wonderful, wonderful colleague named David Tucker. He passed away, unfortunately. But this is a beautiful story. And I can't remember if this is in the book, but he was having trouble with his marriage. He had a wonderful, beautiful wife and two little girls, and they were having struggles, you know, like people do. And he was feeling terrible about himself, and he was feeling I'm not a good dad. I'm not a good provider. I'm not living up to the kind of husband I need to be. You know, I'm a total jerk. Life sucks. I'm terrible. I'm a bad guy. That was where he went into a ceremony with some shamans, a shaman in the Amazonian rainforest where I work. And he shared this with me. And this was a very powerful story for me. And so he wanted the shaman and the ceremony to fix him. That's kind of what his entry request was. And when he was in the ceremony, he heard this booming, clear message, you could say, or voice from wherever. So this takes a little bit of a stretch of one's belief system, but saying, "How dare you," this voice said, "how dare you question my creation? Mm. How dare you doubt the creator?" And it was like, "How dare you insult my creation?" Now, whether you believe in God or a greater being or whatever, this story is instructive, because what happened for David was he realized, no, my life has been given to me. It's a gift. What am I doing? Questioning that, messing with it, making it wrong, putting myself down, making myself completely unable to function. What am I doing with this gift that I've been given? How dare I take the precious gift of life and demean it and diminish it and hold it back? And it was like a, you know, being hit over the head by a 2x4. You know, it's like, oh my God, I need to stop doubting and questioning, and I need to get with the program and just give my best, give my all, give myself over. And I say that that's an example of the voice was calling his doubt and his, "Oh, I couldn't do it. I'm too small. I'm too little. I'm not able. I'm not smart enough. And I'm not handsome enough. I'm not young enough," etc. Insulting that arrogance. In other words, the voice was telling him he was being arrogant rather than modest, or modesty is a form of arrogance. Mm-hmm. Once I think you discover that you're the instrument on the planet now of moving the dial, of moving the action forward, of the transformation we're all seeking, whether we know it or not, then you're humbled by that. And humility is healthy. Humility is honest. Humility is real. It doesn't insult or deny anything. You are in touch with the privilege of being alive. So I just want to say that about this thing, humility, because I think it gets confused with modesty. Modesty is a false degradation of oneself. Humility is discovering who you really are, and it's humbling to discover it.
It's also, I think the etymology of humility is humus, or soil, earth. So it denotes sort of being grounded, really standing in who you are. It's a beautiful word. I agree with you.
Oh, thank you. Humus, I know that. That's information for me. Good.
When I was in my early 20s, and let's just say not living my best life, my late brother-in-law and best friend, Peter, took me to France. Ostensibly, we were going to see and stay with his aunt, but really, I think he wanted to cheer me up. We went to the flea markets in the countryside on the weekends, where I found a set of very old religious medals. I decided to invest these medals with the belief that everything in my life could shift, and it did. I figured out how to frame them myself very badly, and they've stayed with me ever since. When Peter passed away in 2017, these medals became even more important to me, earning pride of place next to my desk. I look at them every day. But my poor framing job from 2002 started to fail recently, and so I decided to entrust them to Framebridge. I've been having Framebridge frame all of my family photos for years. You can upload digital prints, and they do a beautiful and speedy job, making them the perfect place for holiday gifts, as my mother-in-law and parents treasure photos of my kids. But Framebridge also takes on objects that are typically expensive and difficult to frame, whether it's menus, tickets, original artwork, personal milestones, license plates, hotel keys, keys to your first home, or in my case, medals. You can easily order online at framebridge.com or visit one of their 20-plus Framebridge retail stores. They provide free, secure prepaid packaging for physical items, and you can ship them on over. They will then frame your piece and ship it to you in days. It's easy. It's affordable. You know exactly what it will cost up front, and they offer every conceivable framing option. Everything I've ever sent Framebridge has always looked even better than I expected. Plus, if you're not 100% happy with your piece, they'll make it right. See why Framebridge has been trusted to frame over 2 million pieces. Visit framebridge.com or a local Framebridge store to get started and custom frame just about anything. That's framebridge.com.
All right, so this I thought was an incredible moment in the book. You talk about the difference between taking a stand and taking a position and how different they are. And obviously we conflate these two ideas and take a position all the time and work ourselves really into corners, right? Can you talk a little bit about why that's such an important distinction?
Yes. Well, I make a distinction between taking a position and taking a stand in this way. If when you take a position, the nature of positionality is it creates its oppositionality. So if I say yes, it creates no. If I say left, it creates right. If I say up, it generates down. If I say here, it generates there. If I say we, it generates they. So positionality always creates its oppositionality. And positionality, another way of talking about what a position is, it's a point of view. And if you think about the phrase point of view and kind of unpack it, it's a point from which you view. So for example, you know, in a theater, someone sitting in the front row in the center will have a particular point of view of the stage and the actors and the actresses. But someone sitting in the far left side in the last row on the right-hand side will have a very, very different point of view of the stage and the actors and the actresses. Both points of view are totally 100% accurate for the people who are holding them. They're 100% accurate. You really can't argue with the point of view for it is from whence that person is seeing the world. And it's true for them. That's also a position. We form our positions from our point of view, which might be the way we were raised or whether or not we're an American or a Russian or a woman or a man or gay or straight. So our point of view or our position is determined by from whence we see, from where we see. And positionality gets us in a lot of trouble because it's very important. You need to know where you are in the room to get to the door. So that's a point of view. And also that's what's your position on the game board. So it's very important and there's nothing wrong with it, but we get confused and we think our point of view or our position is right and everything else is wrong. When in fact, every point of view is useful. And how I know that is because when you relinquish your point of view and let it go, even slightly, you can have the space, the power of taking a stand. And when you take a stand, it's almost like going up above the auditorium where the people are sitting and seeing all points of view are useful. You know, the director of the production needs to have a vision of where all the points of view in the theater are going to experience the production. But a point of view really is very, very important when you relinquish it and you're committed to something larger than your point of view. What you get back is vision. And that's what you get from taking a stand. Archimedes said, "Give me a place to stand and I'll move the world." And that's what Gandhi had. He took a stand. And then from there, yes, he would drop down, if I can put it that way, and take positions. No, I think the British should get out of India. I think this law is unjust. I think this, I think that. But he didn't become his point of view. Who he was a stand that all people have a chance for a healthy and productive life. Who Martin Luther King was a stand. And when you hear his voice on his birthday on January 15th, they play on NPR all his speeches. And I just love that because you just hear the timber's voice. You hear this is a man who's taken a stand. And it doesn't mean he didn't have positions here and there about this bill and that thing. This is wrong. This is right. But who he was, where he worked from, where he lived from was a stand that all people be freed, be liberated, have a voice, have a chance for a healthy and productive life, just like Gandhi. Most stands are, all stands, I think, really authentic stands are completely inclusive. All stands are something you can't check off. It's not like a to-do. You can't check it off in your lifetime and say, I did that. You don't take credit for your stand. You live it. It's a really powerful way to look at life. And I've taken a stand now, I realize, to live a committed life. I have within that a stand to bring forth an environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, socially just human presence on this planet, which is also the mission of the Pachamama Alliance. That's not something I can check off and say done, but I can participate. I can live my life from that stand. And then the positions or points of view that I take, it's almost like dropping down into the action and taking positions. But from a stand, you're empowered to see, you have true vision and you see all points of view and they're all useful. They're all useful. One's not right and one's not wrong. They're all useful. You see everything. So that's a brief description.
Yeah. And it goes to that Buckminster Fuller quote, that famous quote that you include, you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. And then you write also about within taking a stand for something, not against something, going back to that positionality idea of this is right and that's wrong, but creating the world. I mean, it sounds like such a cliche, but taking a stand for the world that we all want to see, that we recognize would be inclusive, mutually beneficial, sustainable, that long list that you just rattled off, kind, hopefully more just, loving, but that we can't get there. And we're seeing this, right? Like we're seeing government grind to a halt in this country, at least. We're seeing a lot of things. We're living in very interesting times, but we're waiting, I think, for a moment of actually, can we build all of these, as you said, they're people's points of view, which inherently makes them valid. To deny the validity of someone's point of view is to deny their humanity. But how do we understand those points of view and build them towards something bigger?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. There's no formula for it. But if we look at history, we'll see that the people who really changed the game or transformed the situation or moved the dial, I like to say, are people who didn't do it through positionality, actually. So you think about, I mean, Gandhi's is such a great example because my life is my message, he said, and he really lived his stand. Martin Luther King is another beautiful example. I would call Maya Angelou another example. I would call Nelson another example. The people who really changed things really dramatically did it from a place that you and I would call a spiritual root, not from a position. Now, obviously, Nelson Mandela was against apartheid. Of course he was. But what he really lived from is liberating all human souls, including, you know, I tell the story about Nelson Mandela in the book, including his jailers, including the apartheid government. He wanted to liberate them too. He knew it was as painful for them to be crushing Black people and crushing their rights every day. It was dehumanizing them as much as it was dehumanizing the people who they were targeting. And that is a stand. That's like, these are the bad guys and these are the good guys. It's not that way. So even now, you know, I struggle with what's happening in the United States, what's happening. I was just in England, and obviously right now, while you and I are talking, that they're just in a mess. The prime minister just resigned. The queen died. They can't figure out who's in charge over there, and they've left the European Union, and, you know, it's a mess. And everybody's fighting over everything. And the same thing with our country. But people are stuck in their positionality and their points of view, and this person's wrong, this person's wrong. I struggle with it, too, when I think about this whole, the election was stolen, you know, falsehood, etc. But where can I stand for this nation in a way that I can hear all voices, hear the frustration and hurt and upset and and passion that's behind these points of view that have gotten so rigid that they're now like almost crazy? And where can we stand that will allow people to be heard so they can be fully expressed? Because when you're fully heard and fully expressed, you can release your point of view, at least to some extent. When you're not heard, when you're argued with, you get more entrenched. You know, if you look at pro-life and pro-choice, the stronger pro-life gets, the stronger pro-choice gets. I mean, we've just seen this with the reversal of Roe v. Wade. So now everybody's like more positional than ever. So it's not like one side's really going to win. It's more like, where do we stand where we can hear each other's passion, hear each other's reverence for life itself? Where can we find the deep humanity and love and still have our points of view? Not that anybody's wrong and anybody's right, but just be in the inquiry together in a way that we live consistent with our deepest humanity. I don't have a formula for that, but I know that that's what's wanted now. I know that it's like we're in a collective species transformation.
Yeah.
There's a phrase I use in the book that I got from Michael Beckwith and Rev D, Reverend Deborah Johnson: pain pushes until vision pulls. Mm. And the pain that's pushing now is so intense, and pain is going to push us until vision pulls us. And the pain of the positionality and getting more and more rigid and more certain that we're right, and all the algorithms that keep feeding us more information that makes us feel righter and righter and righter, and everybody else wronger and wronger and wronger, is just completely unhealthy. We need to lift ourselves up out of that, listen to each other. And it's hard to do. It's really hard to do because we're so entrenched now. But it's possible. It's possible. If you look at the end of apartheid, that was, I mean, just think about how deep those beliefs were, that people, white people, Afrikaners, were so certain that people of another color were subhuman, that they had to let go of that position, and they were raised generation after generation, to believe that. And the people who had black skin believed it themselves that they were subhuman. They got into that mindset themselves. When you think about the Indians and Gandhi, and that they actually, the British walked out of India. It wasn't a civil war, no. They walked out of India. It's incredible. When you think about and we have so far to go. I'm not saying it's over, and South Africa is still struggling, and prejudice abounds. And look at our country, my God. But at the same time, something's afoot, and really afoot. The climate crisis, as I say in the book, and as I know you know, I believe is powerful, powerful feedback from our mother, mm-hmm. telling her children, come on, you guys. I'm giving you big feedback about the way you're living, the way you're thinking, the way you're relating to me, the way you're relating to the community of life, the way you're relating to each other. The pandemic is feedback, big feedback. Perhaps it is not happening to us. Perhaps it's really happening for us to awaken us so that we can recreate what it means to be human. I think this is epic, 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 epic history in the making now. You know, there's this wonderful phrase from, I think it came from Werner Erhard, I heard it, who founded Aston Landmark. He said, when the first fish crawled up on land, suddenly elephants and eagles were possible. Mm-hmm. And I think we're in that kind of a transformation, an evolutionary leap, where like that moment when a fish crawled up on land and suddenly elephants and eagles were possible. I love that phrase. We're in that kind of a moment, or the breakdowns are everywhere. Everything's not working, which is really kind of awesome because we realize the whole thing is off. The whole thing is not just adjustment over here, adjustment over there. The whole thing is off. The economic system's off, education system's off, healthcare's off. The way we relate to the natural world, the way we relate to animals, the way we relate to food, it's all not wrong. It's just off. And we can adjust that. We must, and I know we will.
Wondering what to give your mom or wife or daughter or friend or godmother for Mother's Day? From someone who cares a lot about her bed and sleep, may I recommend something from Cozy Earth? In fact, becoming a mom and suffering through its required sleep deprivation is where my obsession with sleep started. So it's one of those gifts that might really bring things full circle. After all, women in particular are really impacted by sleep deprivation, which has massive implications for our health. Between the hypervigilance of motherhood and the hot flashes of perimenopause and menopause, we get a raw sleep deal. So let me tell you about giving women you love their best night's sleep ever. Let me tell you about Cozy Earth. Their sheets are made from viscose from bamboo, and they are indescribably soft. So soft, like a bed hug like no other. Now, I'm not the only mega Cozy Earth fan. Every single year since 2018, Cozy Earth products have been named as one of Oprah's favorite things. Oprah picked their best-selling bamboo sheet set because they're temperature regulating and incredibly soft, and she picked their joggers and their socks and their pajamas. Meanwhile, Cozy Earth doesn't just make sheets, they also make pillows, blankets, and more. Cozy Earth makes their products by sourcing responsibly. They use the best suppliers with an eye toward quality, responsible production, cutting-edge technology, and premium materials. They're also incredibly durable. They get better with every wear, and they have an enhanced weave that is guaranteed not to pill even after washing and drying. All Cozy Earth products can be returned or exchanged within 100 days and include an additional 10-year warranty against defects. This Mother's Day, treat mom to the luxury she deserves with Cozy Earth bedding and sleepwear and prioritize her self-care and sleep health. She deserves it. Don't forget to use my promo code THREAD at checkout for 35% off at CozyEarth.com. After placing your order, select podcast in the survey and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows so they know that we sent you. I love that quote about how pain pushes until vision pulls. I mean, it feels like we're in a birth canal. And you talk about, too, the difference between change and transformation. And how, you know, change is almost this micro shift or a disavowal of what's come before us, right? Sort of a, oh, we're just going to go in a different direction and abandon that rather than using everything that we've learned, everything we know to transform, to create and birth something new, a different system, one that's not just moderately tweaked or slightly more evolved, but something wholly, wholly new. Without destroying what's gotten us to where we are. It's a much more loving, in a way, a much more loving word.
Well, and it's all standing on the shoulders of what has come before. You know, it's kind of like an honoring of the past rather than a denigrating of it. It's brought us to the point where we actually now can take an evolutionary leap. We have so many tools, such technology. We're so connected by the internet and the miracle of technology. We understand that trees now are communicating to us. We understand the network, the mycorrhizal fungal network underneath the ground that's now reverberating and communicating with forests of the world, for example. We understand things we didn't understand. And the more we understand, the more we have the permission to take an evolutionary leap. You know, it's an honoring of the past that we can take this kind of a leap now, that we're conscious enough. You know, people like you who are running programs that awaken and enlighten and that are insightful and that talk about the beingness. There's, you know, thousands of podcasts that are doing the work now. And we're all on Zoom, you know, learning how to live in absolute communion with each other. We had a pandemic, we still have it, that connected us, that made it really clear no one can hide. You can lock your doors and put masks on and put air filters everywhere and you still get, you know, you can still get sick. So the universe is telling us over and over and over again that we're in this together, that we're off course, we're not flawed fundamentally, but we're mistaken. and we can correct. And so that's just a treasure of a gift. And you know, we're so fortunate to be alive now with all this is, that has come before. You know, some of it's dark and terrible and we want no more of it, but it's taught us, you know, the George Floyd murder, it was a murder. It was a horrible, viscerally, just almost unconfrontable murder. And we saw it, you know, way more times than we wanted to. And it wasn't the Game of Thrones. It wasn't actors. It wasn't special effects. It was actually someone murdering somebody in the name of the law. And that was not the only one, obviously. You know, there's like hundreds, thousands of them. But that one somehow is pivotal to have us take another really powerful step forward with diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it didn't transform the whole thing. No, we're still colonial in our thinking. We're still, you know, being very, very unkind to each other. There's still rampant racism in all of us. But something is happening. Something is afoot. It's so clearly showing us a new way. And I feel, you know, as when I read the paper, I think, oh my God, or listen to the news, oh my God. However, here we are. And we're in it together, and there's no escape. There's no escape valve. No matter how much money people have, no matter how high the fences are around their island or their mansion, they can't escape it when we run out of water. So we're it's a beautiful, beautiful, humbling time to be alive. Challenging, yes. Difficult, yes. But that's when courage is needed, and courage comes from the heart. We're not going to think our way out of this. We're going to feel our way through it. Mm-hmm. And when we start feeling each other and feeling our way through it, something new will be born in our capacity to be human.
You wrote about your dear friend, Linda Curtis, and this idea of honorable closure, because I thought they were so beautiful as a map for letting something be so that you can move forward into something new. Okay, so the first step is to tell the old story in a new way. And the predominant quality of that step is gratitude. Linda's second step is to resolve any regrets that you may have with willingness and humility. The third step is to let go of the past and let it be. And the primary quality required is forgiveness of yourself and others. And then Linda's fourth step is to invent the next story. And that often is about reclaiming joy. When something ends, there's always something that's beginning. I love that. Stunning. And both also in its acknowledgement of what happened and that idea of letting it be, just let it be. So many of us, I think, ruminate or rehash moments when we wish we could have been better, kinder, more evolved. But to let it be is, I think, so critical to being able to allow yourself to be something new, right?
Yeah, that's a beautiful four-step process. And, you know, it's what she's really written is what we kind of naturally do when we're in touch with ourselves. Mm-hmm. We rethink, oh my God, my divorce was so painful and I was so nasty to my ex. Or, you know, I've heard people say this, I'm not divorced, but I know a lot of women go through that. And I was turned into some sort of a monstrous bitch. Who was that person? And I don't know what happened to me, but I know I'll never be that way again. And then I regret this. And I've got to let go of thinking that he's anything other than the father of my kids and someone I, you know, chose to live life with for a certain number of years. And now I'm so independent and I'm so grateful that I'm free of a relationship that constricted me, and he is too, and we can be friends. And, you know, you hear people do that and you think, wow, how courageous. It takes courage. It takes heart. It's the highest form of love, really. Mother Teresa said, forgiveness is the highest form of love and the most difficult. And it's just powerful to close a chapter in a way that honors it, honors the past, forgives. And that completion really always will generate an experience of love. an experience of love and a new future. They get born at the same time. So yeah, that's a beautiful thing.
It
that
is.
Linda's an expert in that.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What I love about the book and about your life is this difference between service versus servitude. And I think so many women in particular have received a message of selflessness, selfless devotion, unmet needs, or not acknowledging our own needs so that we can serve other people's needs. And that is not what this is about either. I think at the end you write about a friend, I can't remember who had this quote, learn to drink as you pour so the spiritual heart cannot run dry and you always have love to give. And you talk again about another form of arrogance, which is to separate yourself from your work and to presume that you also, that you shouldn't be included in the service. Can you talk a little bit about that, sort of how to bring, rather than abnegating our own needs and our own existence in this idea of service, but how to make it encompass all of it?
Well, I discovered that by not doing that. Oh, I discovered that one. I mean, there's a model, I think it's a 20th century model. And, you know, maybe we just needed to go through that particular period of what's called charity. And, you know, Mother Teresa was a emblem of an iconic version of that. And charity has in it sort of, when you say the word, you kind of think it's got sacrifice in it. You know, you got to sacrifice yourself somehow to be charitable. You have to give up something. And actually, I like to replace the word charity with solidarity. And solidarity is a partnership between people who have different aspects or different, let's say, assets that when they come together, it makes a third thing that's really extraordinary. So I remember a story I don't tell in that book, but I think I told in the last one anyway, I'm telling you now, that I was in Ethiopia after the 1984-1985 famine, and I was with women who'd lost all of their children to starvation. And one woman had lost 11 kids. They'd starved to death. One of them was a baby nursing in her breast. Another woman had lost 7 children. And somehow these women, they were so thin and so weak, but they were still alive. They did everything to save their children. Somehow they, there were 5 of them, who were now childless mothers. And we did a whole grief process around a dry well where they told the story, the excruciating death of each one of their children. And then we would wail after each child's story, the story of each child's death. I mean, it was emotionally the most exhausting thing. It was 5 days and nights. And then I went from Ethiopia to New York to meet with an investment club of women who were wives of mega rich guys on Wall Street. And it was an investment club. And there were actually 7 women in Ethiopia that I just left. And then I went to see 7 women in a Park Avenue glorious apartment. And these women were gorgeous and they'd have every possible thing done to them, massages and, you know, hair and all that stuff. They probably had to have different kinds of plastic surgery. They had more money than God. And they were, I would call, just really hurting in those ways inside that no matter how beautiful you are on the outside, you know, if the inner life is vapid, it hurts. And this was an investment club and they wanted to soul the money talk, but I couldn't even do it because I was so raw from the experience of being with the women in Ethiopia who'd lost all their children to starvation during that famine. And so I told the story of the women in Ethiopia because at the end of the grieving process, the women in Ethiopia, one by one, all 7 of them stood in their, you know, their beautiful Ethiopian garb and they were rail thin and, you know, food aid had come and the famine was over. And they stood and they made a commitment that they would live the rest of their lives to make sure no mother in Ethiopia, do everything they could to make sure no mother in Ethiopia went through what they went through again. And they would get educated, learn to read and write, which they didn't know how to do, learn all kinds of things, and actually go through school. And they wanted to better themselves. And you couldn't tell how old they were, but they were probably about the same age as the women in New York. They're maybe 40s, I'd say. So I told the story of the women in Ethiopia, the women in New York. And the women in New York, you know, and I was crying. I was a complete basket case. And everybody was crying at the end. And then I said, there's seven of you and seven of them. Do you think we could do something that would be a collaboration, a co-equal collaboration? Not that you have everything and they have nothing, because they have strength, courage. They speak the local language. They're committed to educate themselves. They have been through very, very deep grief, so that deepens the soul. They know when their cattle are thirsty by the color of their fur. They know things. They know how to navigate a corrupt government. They know things that are absolutely critical. They have assets, real assets, for ending hunger in Ethiopia. And the women, this is during the Hunger Project years, and the women in New York, you know, they had a lot of assets too. They had money. They could get to people in Congress. They had, you know, some of them private planes. You know, they had all kinds of stuff, material assets, but they were impoverished in their soul. And the women in Ethiopia were so strong and so courageous, and so their inner life was so resilient that they were still alive. And so I put these seven women and these seven women together, but in a way that they saw each other as co-equals, as equals coming together. There was nothing charitable about it. It was solidarity. It was partnership. And the women in New York had, you know, needed something to do with their lives that was meaningful. And this was just incredible for them. And they brought their children to Ethiopia. And, you know, it was amazing. And the women in Ethiopia, you know, all told, after all this, years later, I can tell you that they went all the way through school, you know, kindergarten, all the way. They're in their 40s, all the way through. Four of them are people I still know about. Three of them have PhDs. Can you imagine that? PhDs. Mm. And one is a lawyer. And then the other three I lost track of. One is head of a scientific institute about the environment in Ethiopia. So she has no children anymore, but this is her life, and she's brilliant. Another one is a minister in the government. The government's in trouble right now, but she's still a minister. Another one is the head of a huge university. And then the attorney is one of the leading law firms now in Ethiopia, working on women's rights. And the women in New York made that possible for the women in Ethiopia. The women in Ethiopia made possible the women in New York, in some cases, to leave in a very abusive marriage, in other cases, to raise their children in a way that they didn't become monsters, entitled monsters, because they had these relationships in Africa. They're running foundations. They're just flourishing. So it's an example of, I can't even remember your question, but nobody was sacrificing. Everybody was contributing. Nobody was not included in the transformation. They included themselves. And one of the things we do sometimes with our eagerness to be everything to everybody as women is we do everything for everyone else, and then we just collapse from exhaustion because we forgot to include ourselves. We forgot to eat. We forgot to sleep. We forgot to get a massage. We forgot to take care of ourselves. So it's very typical for women, but it's really a powerful thing to realize, you know, in making the world work for everyone and everything with no one and nothing left out, is not you over here and the world over there. That's here. In there.
Yeah. No, and those shifts, those paradigm shifts are so important. I love this. This is a teaching by Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen that I think about all the time. She says, helping, fixing, and serving represent three different ways of seeing life. When you help, you see life as weak. When you fix, you see life as broken. When you serve, you see life as a whole. And she talks about sort of when we help, we may inadvertently take away from people more than we could ever give them. We may diminish their self-esteem, their sense of worth, integrity, and wholeness. When I help, I am very aware of my own strength. But we don't serve with our strength. We serve with ourselves. We draw from all of our experiences. Our limitations serve, our wounds serve, even our darkness can serve. The wholeness in us serves the wholeness in others and the wholeness of life. I think that's so powerful. Isn't that beautiful?
Is that from my grandfather's blessings, or which book is that from?
I don't know. I read it in Roshi Joan Halifax's book, and it's funny, I have my grandfather's blessings on my bedside table. I don't know. I'll let you know.
Which one of Roshi's books is that in? Which one?
That's in Standing at the Edge.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Such a beautiful, and that's, yet we live in this fixing and helping culture, and that's not inclusive of the self. Might be giving of the self, but in a way that's not necessarily, there are unintended consequences to that. So I love that idea of just service and seeing the other as whole.
Yeah, that's a quote. Wow. I should have put that in my book. It's too late.
Dang it. I know, you're off to the printers. I'd like to think of myself as a proactivist. I love that term. And it can be hard, as she said, particularly in the context of everything that's happening here and around the world. And I think we can look at the fact that it's happening all around the world as another example of those cosmic death pains, so that we can go back into the womb and come out anew, that we're all experiencing. These aren't isolated events. This is something that's global on scale. And we went over a little quickly, so I wanted to go back to it, but this difference between transformation and change, and why I think that this slight shift in language that she uses is so powerful. We talk a lot about change, and sure, we want change in some contexts. It's a totally adequate word. But it suggests that what came before is inherently wrong, bad, or the wrong direction. And I think as we try to acknowledge so that we can process fully where we've been, so that we can honor it for the way that it's shaped us in the here and now, we need to think about something that's a bit bigger than change, a bit more all-encompassing. Rather than just, oh, we took that wrong turn, so we're going to take a right turn. It doesn't really metabolize history. In a way, it's sort of just trying to move away from the things that we might not like about ourselves, either as people or as a country or as humanity. It suggests, oh, yes, those were vile things and we're in a new direction, rather than actually taking the time to recognize and integrate where we've been. So she says, transformation has a completely different dynamic than change. Transformation doesn't accuse the past or current situation of being wrong, bad, or undesirable. Rather, transformation shifts the perspective such that what so or what came before suddenly makes sense. It embraces the current reality and has it make sense in a new light. Transformation actually completes the past, makes sense of the present, and generates a future that blossoms out of what's so now. It turns what is deemed no longer useful or not right into the perfect platform or pathway to the next space. It is respectful rather than critical, affirms rather than denies, includes rather than excludes. It becomes a platform from which we take the next leap. And this is a hard distinction, of course, because there are so many things in our personal past and our collective past that fill us with shame and that we would love to undo or have never have happened at all. And yet it did. It's the truth. And denying it isn't getting us anywhere either. So I'm here for the transformation. Less so for just change. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to this week's episode.
You can find show notes and full transcripts of the episodes at theelisepodcast.com. Please sign up for my newsletter. I promise I won't spam you. Or follow me on Instagram at Elise Lunan to get updates on new episodes. I'd also like to give a huge thank you to my sponsors who make this show possible. Please support them the way they support this podcast. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studio. If you enjoyed this episode, please listen, rate, review, and follow Pulling the Thread, available now for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts, i.e. wherever you're listening right now. I also want to thank you in advance for sharing any episodes with friends who you think might like the show, because that is how podcasts grow. I want to give a shout out to Phil Svitek, Lauren LaGrasso, Serena Reagan, Mary-Kate McDonough, and the entire Cadence 13 team for producing these episodes, and to Valero Duvall for my key art. Take care of yourselves. I'll see you next week.